Thank you, Gilbert, and good afternoon to all of you. Hope you're enjoying your Sabbath today. As we begin, I'd like to see if we can maybe agree on one fact. And that is this, that nothing in the Bible is simply a story about something that happened a long time ago. No, the Bible was written, and every story was particularly placed in there because it has significant meaning both to the people of that day and in every generation since, all the way down to our generation. It is for our benefit that those stories are put in there. And if we can start from that premise, I'd like to begin by looking at a story that we find in Genesis. In Genesis 11, we find a very interesting story. It's the story of the Tower of Babel. Now, some of you who are quick on your hands might be thinking, that's not the true beginning, and you'd be right, because we want to begin in chapter 10 and verse 8, and we want to look at what happens there. Here we find that in verse 8, a man by the name of Cush begat Nimrod, and Nimrod, he began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. That's the real beginning of the story of the Tower of Babel. Now, as we have covered in previous times, the names are very important. God names things what they are. Now, there are lots of biblical commentaries and people who will talk about Nimrod and what his name means and what he did. But let me just begin by reading one quotation. It comes from the Companion Bible. You could find some of this in Josephus and other places. Here's what it says. It says, regarding Nimrod, he was powerful in hunting and in wickedness before the Lord, for he was a hunter of the sons of men. And he said to them, depart from the judgment of the Lord and adhere to the judgment of Nimrod. The word Nimrod in Hebrew means to rebel, or we will rebel, or even come let us rebel. We begin to see a little bit of what this story about the Tower of Babel is all about just in the founding father of Babel. So his name means rebel. It's clear that he was in opposition to God, and he was actually hunting men. He was killing men. All right, now, let's begin reading in chapter 11, and we'll read through it, and then we'll go back and we'll isolate a few items and expound them. In verse 1, it says, now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said one to another, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. And they had bricks for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city, and a tower whose top is into the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to the city to see the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they have one language. And this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down, therefore, and confuse their language, that they may not be able to understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them from abroad and over the face of the whole earth, and they ceased the building of the city. Now I want to look at a few things because it's very significant what is happening here. So let's begin by just noticing that he says one language and one speech. God is not repeating himself. He doesn't stumble or stutter. These are two different words meaning two different things. One is language like what we think of. Let's say maybe they were speaking Hebrew. That's probably a reasonable guess. But the second, one speech, well, that is unity of sentiment. They were saying the same words. So they came there, this whole mass of people, and they were not only speaking one language, but they had one concept. They were unified in their purpose or sentiment. That's the first thing we want to comment on. The second thing, notice a little phrase, journeyed from the east. Now, in biblical nomenclature, journeyed from the east is not a point on the compass. It has to do with spiritual direction. And east, in biblical nomenclature, means a source of spiritual wisdom. Much the same way that left hand and right hand aren't directions, but they are a symbol or a meaning for good and evil. If you go to the book of Jonah at the very end, you'll see that in Nineveh, there were 120,000 people who did not know their left hand from their right hand. Well, this is 120,000 people who did not know right from wrong. In biblical nomenclature, that's what this is meaning. So what seems to be meaningless, they journeyed from the east, what does that mean? It means a whole lot. It means that they are leaving their spiritual source of wisdom to follow something else. Of course, by the name of Nimrod, we get an idea what this is going to be. All right, so now the other thing, this asphalt for mortar. The scholars will tell you this asphalt was very special because it was watertight. It was waterproof. So now they want to build a city that is waterproof. Okay? They don't want to scatter and repopulate the earth like they were told to after the flood. They want to congregate together. They want to build something that's waterproof. How high do they want to build it? To the heavens. I wonder why. Maybe it's because they figure the waters of the flood will never get up into heaven. All right. Now what's interesting too, God comes down to the earth. Can you think another time where God says, I got to go down to the earth and see what's happening? Yeah, you're probably thinking of Sodom and Gomorrah. That's right. The evil was so bad, God says, I'm going to have to go down and check this out for myself before I destroy this city. So what does he do? He comes down here, not because they're building a building, but because of why they were building it, why they were united. People talk about one world, the new world order. Well, I think this is the beginning of that. Here you have this whole group of people, all united in purpose, to rebel against God, to build a city in defiance of the command to go out and scatter and populate the earth, and they don't want to trust God's command, that his promise that I won't flood the earth again. Either they didn't believe him or they didn't want to rely on him. Nonetheless, they were building a building to reach the stars that was waterproof. And they were doing it under this leadership of this man named Nimrod, meaning to rebel or let's come rebel. Very interesting. So what does God do? He puts up two barriers to stop this. He says, first of all, you're not going to speak the same language. You are not going to understand each other. Second of all, I'm going to scatter you. Since you won't do it yourself, you are scattered. You are over here, you over there, try and get over those mountains, try and get over those rivers, try and cross those hundreds of miles between each and every one of you. That should put a stop to this. And it did for a while. So we don't have time to go into it, but there's an element of multiculturalism that would come into play here. So summing up, we see a world moving away from its religious and moral foundation. They moved from the east, giving rise to secularism. They wanted a government and a city that had nothing to do with God and God's wishes and his purposes. So secularism was on the rise, and under the direction of a strong man, a man of sin, a full-scale rebellion is led. The Tower of Babel became a symbol of this rebellion. Much the same way when Israel asked for a king, it was synonymous with them rejecting God. So the Tower of Babel is a symbol of man's rebellion and wanting to build their own government. Now, what does this have to do with us today? A lot. Now, if you think about it, I have marveled for a couple of years that the two barriers that God placed on man at the Tower of Babel no longer exist. Are we limited by the distance from one country to the next? I don't think so. When my friend Dusty was in China, I got on my computer. How you doing, Dusty? Just fine, Dan. Right now, the weather's such and such. Internet made that distance seem as if he was next door. I could get up in the morning and chat with him. I can get on the plane at the feast, and in less than a day, I can be all the way in the Philippines. Anything that is significantly in terms of science, mathematics, or any important literary work, it is translated right away into multiple different languages. They got computers that can automatically do the language translation. These are no longer hindrances to us. So now we see that we come to a point in time that man has never had before because we have eliminated the barriers that God set up at the Tower of Babel. And so anything that is set before us now, what can stop us? What can't we do? Now, What I'm going to say to you, that there is right now a Tower of Babel being built. It is starting to rise up, and today it would be in the form of the European Union. This is a government that is being built, but its foundations are not God. It is secular, meaning devoid of God, rejecting religious and God, and especially anything from Mosaic law. They fully embrace multiculturalism. The form of government is built, and they, as a nation and as they're forming, they had the sole purpose of resisting and countering the United States of America. Now, let me read to you a fascinating quote. It comes from a book by a man by the name of Jeremy Rifkin. And he studied and watched for years the formation of the European Union. He's been collecting all of this material. And on page 212 of his book, The European Dream, and the subtitle is How the European Dream is Replacing the American Dream. All right, on page 211, he says, "My first impression in reading over the European Constitution was that large chunks of it would never be accepted by the majority of the American people." He goes on, "To begin with, there is not a single reference to God, and only a veiled reference to Europe's religious inheritance. God is missing. Strange, in a continent where great cathedrals grace the central plazas of most cities, and small churches and chapels appear around every corner, still most of the ancient sanctuaries are visited primarily by tourists nowadays. One would be hard-pressed to see more than a scattering of local people at a Sunday morning mass. As mentioned in the opening chapter, for the most part, Europeans, especially post-war generation, have left God behind. Europe is arguably the most secular place on earth." Isn't that interesting? The most secular place on earth. Most agree with Ana Palacio, Spain's former foreign minister and a member of the drafting convention, who argued, quote, "Our only banner is secularism," end quote. A French diplomat put it even more bluntly, "We don't like God. We don't want God." This is a nation whose constitution is very clear. The founding fathers of the European Union are very clear. They don't want God in what they're building. They don't want America in what they're building. And they want something that can stand up as an opposition and a counter to America. And they don't like Israel either. I wonder why. So here we see a nation being formed that is built on this secularism. And just amazing. And there are so many things in this book that show, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tie-ins to show that they are building something to counteract what America is. That America has a foundation in God, God we trust. They got a foundation in secularism, no God. They trust in themselves. They trust in this thing. And they want to build something that is economical and that is rewarding, and it gives the world another place to go. So now, this is another fascinating thing. It comes once again, and it ties in ancient Tower of Babel to modern Tower of Babel. It comes from the Companion Bible, talking about Nimrod. It says, "We cannot fail to see in Nimrod Satan's first attempt to rise up a human universal ruler of men. There have been many subsequent attempts, such as Nebuchadnezzar, Alexander, Napoleon, and others. But he," meaning Satan, "will finally succeed in the person of the Antichrist." And isn't it interesting what we know about the Antichrist and where he comes and what government he rules in the future? He's going to rule that secular government. He's going to get control of this new Tower of Babel. The one difference today we see the Tower of Babel being built without this strong leader, without this man of sin. In ancient Tower of Babel, the man of sin existed first. But here we see this government, this thing being grown, this rebellion is growing, and eventually that one man's going to stand on there. Now, it is with this understanding that we could begin to understand so many things that happen in our world around us. From there, it's easy to understand the anti-American sentiment the crazy decisions judges are making, the willingness to tolerate anything except for Christian thoughts and ideals and morals, the increase in piercings and tattoos. Why, America's real threat is not terrorists. Even the mapping of the genome and all the amazing things in science, seems like every day we turn around, they can do something else. Last thing I heard of, they're actually putting human brain cells in a mouse. They're trying to create the stuff that they think black holes are made of. And they're doing this stuff. All of this and much more could be explained from this, but we're going to have to save it for part two of the Tower of Babel, from ancient times to modern, coming to a theater near you. Now, I'm just kidding about the theater part, but I'd like to go back to this because it is so fascinating. It explains so many of the strange things we see and the contradictions, even the divide in our nation, can be explained when you understand what was going on in the Tower of Babel and how time repeats itself. Everything old is new, everything new is old. So let me leave you with one final thought. We know that God says that the end days are as those of the days of Noah. What was happening in the days of Noah? One, they did not understand that the age they lived in had changed. See, God had come down and at some point God says, that's it, I'm going to flood this earth. What used to be the norm and the reality had just shifted, totally unaware of it. They had no concept that life had just changed. They also did not recognize that they lived in perilous times all of a sudden. There was peril coming and they lived oblivious to it. And they did not change their behavior to match the times they lived in. The last thing is that those in the days of Noah, they did not heed God's warning. That warning message went out for 120 years. Repent. You can get on this boat. There's a lifeboat. They had no heeding to that warning, nor did they redeem the time. So the question I ask myself is, do I comprehend the times I live in? Do I comprehend the fact that times have changed, and what will I do with that knowledge if I do comprehend?